ash smeared on Tyla's face. It was suddenly hard to breathe. With great care, so as not to disturb any more of the ash, I lowered the corner of the photograph until it lay flat on the table. Slowly, I backed away and got my cell phone. I dialed Carmen at home. "Hey, it's Abe. About those photographs of Tyla and me?"
"It's taken care of, Abe.
You don't need to be worrying about this at home." "No, this is important," I said, catching my breath. "They're not from BB&L. Chapter 14. Before the Osobuku was called, our house was a crime scene. I was convinced that the photos were from Tyler's killer, which meant that a serial killer had stood on our front porch and reached into our mailbox. The photographs and envelope were bagged and sent to the lab. The mailbox was dusted for fingerprints. Our driveway was checked for tire tracks, the yard and walkway for footprints. A uniformed police officer was parked on our street, keeping an eye on our house, and he would remain there overnight. It was every prosecutor's worst nightmare that his work would put his family in danger, and I wasn't taking any chances. Angelina kept our bedroom. She didn't answer my knocks, but Rid was able to get through to her, and he was talking with her privately, taking her statement. The front door was wide open, members of the forensic team coming and going when Agent Santos arrived. Her attention was immediately drawn to the broken wine glass on the cocktail table. I had prosecuted enough domestic violence cases to know how that must have looked. "A little accident," I said.
"I see.
Just some spilled wine." She didn't answer. I was beginning to think that the stars had aligned against any hope of regaining her trust. Rid entered from the hallway and joined us in the living room. The statement he'd taken from Angelina was on his clipboard. "Not much to add," he told us. "The envelope was in the box with the rest of the mail. She's sure that she checked the mailbox yesterday and it wasn't there. So we can focus on the last 24 hours when talking to neighbors about anyone they might have seen." Santos took the clipboard and gave it a quick once-over.
"I saw Ash only on the last photo," she said. "Did you ask if she brushed off any of the others?"
"She didn't," said Rid. "In fact, she had no idea what I was talking about when I mentioned Ash. She never got to the last photo. After the third one, she ran to the bathroom and vomited. That hurt, as if I needed to feel worse than I already did." A crime scene photographer entered the living room, begging our pardon. I moved our group toward the kitchen, allowing Santos to enter first, managing to get a couple words in privately with Rid on the way.
"How's Angelina?" I asked.
"Drunk as a skunk."
"You think she'll talk to me tonight?"
"I'd wait till the morning if I were you."
I trusted his read, and I wondered if we all might be working till morning. Technically, I was off the Cutter Investigation Task Force, but the photos had drawn me back in, at least to this limited extent.
We took seats at the kitchen table, and I was about to pick up the conversation, but Rid went in another direction.
"Man, it smells awesome in here. Is that oxtail?"
"Veal shank," I said. "Angelina's an amazing cook."
"You're a lucky guy, Abe," said Santos.
"I know I am. I may not deserve her, but I'm a good husband."
"I hope you work it out," she said. "Nothing snarky about it. I mean that."
"Thank you."
Maybe those stars were realigning after all. Or she was playing good cop, bad cop all by herself.
"So what's really up with this ash?" asked Rid.
"I have no doubt the lab will confirm that it's sugar cane," said Santos.
"Let's assume it does," I said.
"In terms of profiling, do you consider the ash on the photo to be the equivalent of the signature in the Palm Beach County murders?" Santos thought carefully before responding.
"First off, I can say that we are never going to know whether there was ash on Tyler's actual face. Have you given up hope of recovering the rest of her body? I asked.
Not entirely, but we're coming up on 6 full days. With predators, parasites, and the general acceleration of decomposition in the Everglades, it's unlikely we'll find skin, let alone traces of sugarcane ash.
Let me ask my question a different way then, I said. Is the photograph enough for you to officially say that Tyla is victim number 5 for Cutter?
I would be leaning more in that direction if Tyla were white and had a black boyfriend, like the other victims. Rid rose to check out the platter of ossobuco on the counter. Interracial threat is still there. Tyla's a black woman who was hooked up with white guys.
I did not let on that Carmen had told me about Tyla and Brian Belter. I assume you mean me 10 years ago, I said. Right, sorry, said Rid.
Whoever, whenever, said Santos, the fact remains that we have our first black victim, with no way to know if ash was smeared on her face like the previous white victims.
Rid grabbed a fork. Can I try some of this? Go for it.
I kept my focus on Santos, who, in my opinion, was being too cautious.
If I was still on the case, I'd have no problem arguing to a jury that this is the work of the same killer.
His lawyer would point out that the photo came 5 days or more after Tyla was murdered, said Santos, almost like an afterthought.
What do you mean, an afterthought?
I can't rule out a copycat killer, said Santos. You heard the medical examiner describe how different Tyla's wounds were from those of the victims in Palm Beach County. So let's say we have a copycat who watches the news and decides that attacking victims with a machete is Cutter's signature. He whacks his victim on the neck and disposes of the body in the Everglades. Afterward, he somehow learns that Cutter's signature isn't the use of a machete, that it's ash on the victim's face. What can our copycat do? Well, one option is to send photographs to the lead prosecutor's home with ash smeared on Tyler's face.
How would he find out that ash was the signature that's been kept under wraps?
Our task force is growing. The number of people in the know is increasing. Media tension is expanding. Leaks happen.
I see your point, I said. But that raises another question. Whether we're talking about Cutter or a copycat, how did he get those photographs of Tyla and me off a restaurant security camera in the first place?
I'm working with FDLE and the Orange County Sheriff's Department on that. But there's only one way that the killer would have known that Tyla was having dinner with a white man on that night at that restaurant. He must have been stalking her.
All the way back to September? Asked Rid.
It's not unusual, said Santos. I've looked inside the computers of serial killers and found photos of victims going back years.
I've prosecuted a few of them, I said.
And hearing myself say that raised my concerns for Angelina once more. Not to change the subject, but I know we have a squad car on our street overnight. What are we doing long term? God forbid if the message being sent here is that my wife is next on the list.
Santos shook her head.
Angelina doesn't fit the victim profile. She's not a white woman dating a black man or a black woman who dates white men.
I don't take a huge comfort in that, I said.
Rid was still at the counter, his mouth full.
We can get increased patrol in this neighborhood, eh? That's no problem.
Thanks.
Good sticky rice, he said. It's mushroom risotto.
The landline rang. It was on the counter right next to Rid.
You want me to get this?
He asked.
Who is it?
Rid checked the caller ID.
It's you,
he said. Let it go, I said.
Yeah, I don't answer your calls either.
The ringing stopped.
It's JT, I explained.
He lives in the apartment Samantha and I used to live in. He has no credit. All the utilities are still in my name. The ringing resumed.
It's you again, said Rid.
Leave it.
Okay, but if you call one more time, I'm going to have to take you downtown for stalking yourself.
Very funny, I said.
But the joke suddenly took on a different twist. The elephant in the room was that those photographs of Tyla and me, our dinner last September, couldn't be viewed in isolation. She had followed up with phone calls to my cell. The record showed 5 from her prepaid phone. Maybe not enough to constitute stalking, as Rit had joked, but I was suddenly wondering if there had been others. Tyla had a persistent personality. She wasn't the type to dial a man's cell, get no response, and leave it at that. I wondered if she had tried more than just my cell. My old number, for instance, which was the only number she would have retrieved through directory assistance if she had asked for the listing for Abraham Beckham. The home number for Angelina and me was listed under her name. A third round of ringing started on the landline.
"Okay, that's it," said Rid.
"You're under arrest." I pushed away the table and answered. The voice on the line was calm by JT standards.
"Hi. The judge said I could visit the old man once a week during house arrest. Can we go tomorrow?"
The old man was my father-in-law, Luther Vine.
"Sure," I said. "We can do that. I'll be right over." "No, not tonight. Tomorrow," said JT.
It was a long shot, but I was eager to get over there and check JT's answering machine, my old answering machine.
"I understand," I said.
"I'll be there in a few." I hung up and apologized to the cutter team in my kitchen. "Stay as long as you need. I have to go." Santos watched me, and Rid made himself a plate as I headed out the door. Chapter 15. JT's apartment was a short car ride from my house. Our conversation on the landline had clearly confused him, so I called him on the way and explained what was going on.
"What answering machine?"
he asked. JT had no clue, which came as no surprise. He'd been living in our old apartment for over a year and had only recently mastered the coffee machine. Forget the computer. And an answering machine?
"I actually don't trust them," said JT.
I didn't even ask. The machine was connected to the landline on the kitchen counter. It was a bit of a dinosaur in the world of voicemail, but I'd changed very little about the apartment Samantha and I had shared, so the answering machine remained. The digital memory was completely full. "You have 87 new messages," the mechanical voice informed me. JT had truly never checked the thing. The newest message was about a month old. The oldest new message went back more than a year, to his first day in the apartment. I should have started at the most recent and worked backward. Instead, I ventured into the most dangerous territory of all. Old messages that had been played long ago but not erased. Messages from Samantha to me. Some were random gems, just the sound of her voice. "Abe, why aren't you answering your cell? Call me." Others made me smile all the way to my toes. "It's 11 o'clock. Do you know where your wife is?" "Work. So sorry, baby. Don't wait up." One tugged at my heartstrings. "Hi, sweetie. Are you there? It's me. Pick up if you can hear me." And then there was the dagger to the heart. "Abe, I hate to do this, but can you move our dinner reservation to tomorrow night? Dr. Birch wants me to drive all the way over to Jackson for a couple of tests, and 7 o'clock tonight is the only time the lab can squeeze me in this week on short notice. I'm sure this is nothing, but Dr. Birch is such a nervous Nelly that she's even got me worked up. I'll make it up to you. Promise. I love you. Happy anniversary." So there it was. The pain in the neck doctor ordering the abundance of caution test that would mark the beginning of the long and painful road to the point of no return. Funny thing was, the first time I'd listened to that message, I'd taken Samantha's word at face value and agreed that it was probably nothing. A few weeks later, I would be glued to cancer websites, learning that mammograms missed plenty in women with denser tissue
and praying that Samantha wouldn't be another number in the grim statistical fact that black women were twice as likely to develop triple negative breast cancer and twice as likely to die from it before the age of 40. Knowing all that and knowing how the story would end, I could hear the concern in Samantha's voice on this replay of the old message on her answering machine. Samantha had known something was wrong with her. So wrong that she'd canceled dinner on her wedding anniversary.
Me again, Abe.
I froze. Tyler Tompkins' voice was coming from my old answering machine.
You obviously have chosen to ignore my messages, but this is not a ruse that I'm playing to hook up with you.
This is real. I said more than I should have said in my last message. This is damaging to my firm and my client. I'm trusting you to be discreet, so please delete this message and the other ones I left on your cell. If you don't want to talk to me, that's fine, but at least have the sense to follow up with that old cane cutter I mentioned in the last message. He knows everything. There was silence, but the message wasn't over. Finally, her voice returned with one last thought. Angelina, you don't know me and I don't know you, but if you pick up this message, I'm not an old girlfriend trying to hit on your husband. Please make sure Abe gets this. It's important. End of message, the machine told me. I rewound to get the date and time. December 12th, 8:31 p.m. I hit stop and grabbed a pen and paper from the junk drawer to create a timeline. I didn't have the exact dates in my head, but I knew from the prepaid phone record that the last of the four deleted messages on my cell phone had been the first week of December. This message asked me to delete the earlier ones. They, in fact, had been deleted, and I knew I was going to have a tough time convincing anyone that I had not deleted them. I replayed Tyler's message and wrote it out verbatim in longhand, jotting down a few notes and questions as well. I had more questions in my head, and I hoped to find a more recent message from Tyler that might provide some answers. It took nearly half an hour to play through to the last message. The memory card had reached maximum capacity on December 29th. It was all solicitation calls after December 12th. Nothing more from Tyler. JT entered the kitchen and went to the refrigerator.
I'm out of everything, he said, holding the door open.
Can you go to the store for me tomorrow?
Yeah, sure, JT. I'm going to have some people come over here tonight and pick up this machine.
I'm going to bed.
You go ahead.
Did you find what you were looking for?
The notepad was still on the counter, and I glanced at the message from Tyler that I'd written out in longhand. I honestly don't know what I found. The answer seemed to satisfy him. JT went to bed. I dialed Ritt on my cell, so eager to talk to him that I was counting the rings. But something made me hang up before he answered. It bothered me that there was still so much ice to thaw between me and the FBI. And if it was melting away at all, progress was glacier-like. My first call about this breakthrough had to be to the right person. I dialed Agent Santos. I was recording Tyler's message on my smartphone when Santos knocked on JT's door. I had replayed it several times while waiting on Santos. Suddenly, a terrifying image popped into my head, an old Mission Impossible moment of the answering machine sizzling and self-destructing before my eyes, taking Tyler's message with it. The smartphone backup kept me from self-destructing. Come on in, I said. I was glad to see that Ridd had come with her. He tagged and bagged the answering machine as evidence in the cutter investigation while Santos and I listened to a recording of the message on my smartphone over and over again.
Play it one more time, said Santos.
Ridd joined us at the table for the fifth replay. In the span of 2 hours, we'd basically swapped Angelina's kitchen for Samantha's, transplanting ourselves from the present to my past, which seemed almost metaphorical, given the way the night had unfolded.
Santa's created another page of notes on her yellow pad as Tyler's voicemail message played yet again. When it finished, I was more than ready to hear Santos's impression.
What do you think?
I asked. Let's start with the obvious, she said. It appears that Tyler was trying to tell you something about one of BB and L's clients, presumably something that is damaging to the firm and the client. The reference to the old cane cutter, who knows everything, would suggest that the client is Cortina Sugar. I'm with you so far, I said.
Which is interesting, said Rid, because Brian Belter told us that Tyler was working for Cortina Sugar before she died.
But she couldn't have been calling Abe about anything she was working on recently, said Santos.
Why not?
I asked. Santos checked her notes. Tyler's exact words were that an old cane cutter knows everything. It's been 2 decades since the sugar companies replaced manual labor with machines. So Tyler had to be talking about something that happened at least 20 years ago. Maybe longer.
That raises an important point, I said. As a lawyer, Tyler would understand that after a certain period of time, the statute of limitations would bar criminal prosecution. So if she was calling to tip me off about a crime, very few crimes have a limitations period that reaches back 2 decades or more.
Murder does, said Rid.
That's definitely one of them, I said. Basically, we're talking about a felony that results in death or one that carries a punishment of life imprisonment or the death penalty. A felony that results in death could be any kind of criminal negligence, said Santos. Let's not be too quick to say she was talking about cold-blooded murder.
But let's not be too quick to jump back in time either, said Rid. Maybe Tyler wasn't talking about an old murder. Maybe she was talking about an old murderer.
I know what you're saying, said Santos, but I think it's a stretch.
I'm asking more than saying, said Rid. Is it possible that when Tyler mentioned an old cane cutter who knows everything, she meant cutter? As in our cutter?
An old serial killer does not fit our profile, said Santos. In fact, it doesn't fit any profile I've ever seen.
I'm not talking geriatric, said Rid. Some of the H2 visa cutters were 18 or 19 years old. An old cane cutter could still be in his late 30s, early 40s.
What was the date of the first Palm Beach murder? I asked. November 29th, said Santos, almost 2 weeks before Tyler left this message.
So I may be onto something, said Rid. The old cane cutter who knows everything could be Cutter.
I shook my head.
It still doesn't make sense. Why would Tyler have any reluctance to pass along information about a former sugarcane cutter who might be our serial killer? She asked me to be discreet because it could be damaging to her firm and to her client. Passing along information about a murderer is not that kind of sensitive information.
There's another possibility, said Santos, her gaze shifting squarely toward me. Maybe she just wanted you to call her back.
Well, clearly she wanted to talk to me, I said. That's how a whistleblower operates.
What I meant to say is that's all she wanted, said Santos. There was no other purpose for her call.
Let me be sure I understand, I said. You're saying that she pretended to be passing along information about a crime just so I would call her back?
Sounds crazy, said Rid. But when I was a patrol cop, I ticketed a woman who ran her car into some guy driving a Porsche just so she could meet him.
A woman who does something like that is not a successful partner in Miami's largest law firm.
Don't be so sure, said Santos. Tyler seemed to be going out of her way to try to convince you that this was not a ruse. She even reached out to your wife by name, in case she listened to the message, trying to put Angelina at ease that she wasn't hitting on you.
Santos may have a point, said Rid. When a woman with Tyler's track record tries that hard to convince a man that she's not gunning for him, I say hold on to your underwear.
This can't be, I said. Tyler would have to have been some kind of sociopath.
Santos gave me the proverbial if-the-shoe-fits expression. We're talking about a woman who owned 3 different diamond engagement rings with matching wedding bands, who called married men on a prepaid cell phone to avoid detection, and who apparently was sleeping with the managing partner of her law firm. You knew Tyler better than I, Abe. But what I've learned about her so far doesn't rule out at least some sociopathic tendencies.
Well, I didn't know her very well either, I said.
We had our thing 10 years ago. We had dinner last September, that was it.
Truth? Asked Santos.
Yes, that's the truth.
Did she want more than dinner?
What difference does that make?
There I went again, answering a question with a question.
A big difference, said Santos, to someone of her psychological makeup. If you blew her off, that makes you the one who got away. You're a challenge, a mountain to climb, the deal that never closed.
I get it, I said, shutting down the raging river of metaphors.
Santos narrowed her eyes, pressing the point as if switching to interrogation mode. That goes double if you led Tyler to believe that you wanted her, but in the end you were just playing her. You spit the hook, so to speak. You went back to your hotel room and she went back to hers. Or maybe things got even murkier than that. Maybe the two of you were on your way up to her room, still feeling that bottle of wine, standing too close, or even some touching in the elevator. But when she opened the door and invited you in, maybe in words, maybe just with her eyes, something stopped you. Something made you say good night and walk away.
Where are you going with this? I asked.
Just looking inside her head, said Santos, trying to see if Tyler had something other than crime tips on her mind when she called you. But there's no way for me to know, is there, Abe? Only the two of you were there, and one of you is dead. You're the only one who can tell us if Tyler wanted more than just dinner. I considered what Santos was saying, considered all of her insinuation. I can't say that I was comfortable studying Tyler's motives in Orlando, but it was interesting to me from a tactical standpoint how Santos had managed to frame her question strictly in terms of Tyler's intentions and not mine. Without having been there, without ever having met Tyler, Santos seemed to have a better handle on how it had gone down than I did. Or she simply understood how the male ego would like to remember it.
There's no question, I said. Tyler wanted more.
Chapter 16. It was almost midnight when I got home. The police officer was parked on our street, as promised. How much he was actually keeping watch was debatable. He was texting on his phone as I drove past him. The front door was locked. I tried not to make too much noise, inserting the key gently, turning the latch slowly, and praying that the alarm didn't sound as I pushed open the door. My cat-like entry was partly out of courtesy, a genuine effort not to rouse Angelina from a deep sleep. The more powerful force at work, however, was that waking her would mean a midnight conversation about Tyler. I had had enough of Tyler Tompkins for one night, but there seemed to be no avoiding the issue. Angelina was on the couch, wide awake and watching Lifetime.
I didn't expect you to be up, I said as I closed the front door behind me.
She was wearing her nighttime comfort outfit, a big terry cloth robe with fuzzy slippers. She didn't look at me. Her gaze remained fixed on the flat screen.
Neither did I, she said.
Were you waiting up for me? Her head turned slowly in my direction and her expression said it all. Sorry, my bad, I said. I hung my car keys on the hook by the door and took a seat in the armchair.
What's up with the squad car outside our house? She asked.
It's a precaution, I said. There's a possibility that Tyler's killer sent those photographs to you. That made her head turn. Are you kidding me? A serial killer stood on our doorstep and dropped off those photographs of you and Tyler? Possibly. Wonderful. Some wives have Dr. Phil on their side. I got Ted Bundy watching my back. No one's watching, said the man who thought so until the photographs proved him wrong. She looked away embarrassed. Sorry. She was clearly still feeling the bottle of wine she'd finished by herself, her drunk and sober halves clashing. Don't apologize, I said. I deserve that. We'll get to what you deserve, she said coolly. But seriously, if no one's watching, why is there a squad car out there? We're just being careful, I said. Agent Santos does not believe there's any danger. No danger, really. No. She looked at me again, this time even more intently. And what do you think, Abe? Do you think there's any danger? I was pretty sure she wasn't talking about the serial killer, but I had no idea what the right answer was. To put a finer point on it, she said, what about us? Do you think we're in any danger? Definitely not talking about a serial killer, but I was still looking for that right answer. I hope not. She exhaled loudly, something between a scoff and a mirthless chuckle. Oh, Abe, you are such a piece of work. I moved forward in the armchair, still seated, but leaning toward her, beseeching her. Do you want me to tell you what happened that night? Angelina switched off the television with the remote, then looked me in the eye. I know what happened. No, I don't think you do. Photographs don't lie, Abe. You were having a very good time. It was a nice dinner. Angelina should have unloaded on me for such a stupid comment, but she didn't. I've been to nice dinners, she said in a calm, even voice. That's not what this was. I saw the smile on your face. I saw the look in your eye, Angelina. I'm telling you the truth. I did not sleep with Tyler. I wish that's all it had been. What? No. Seriously, you think I was in love with Tyler? She shook her head as if to emphasize that I just didn't get it. No, Abe, I don't think for one second that you were in love with Tyler. You're in love with Samantha. And for 2 hours at that dinner, Tyler was your dead wife. Angelina pushed herself up from the couch. She stood there as if debating whether to say more, then gathered up her long blonde hair and put it up in a clip. I know you didn't sleep with Tyler, Abe. But you and I both know that it had nothing to do with how much you love me. I didn't move. I couldn't move. I stayed in the armchair as Angelina walked alone to our bedroom. Chapter 17. I juggled Friday's workload and whittled it down to one early hearing at the courthouse. I was out by lunchtime. My afternoon was full, starting with the drive to Palm Beach County for a visit with a legal aid hero. At least he thought of himself as a hero. Ed Brumble was an ideologue, a relic of the 1960s, and a magna cum laude graduate of Harvard Law who had shunned the Wall Street law firms and devoted his entire career to epic legal battles that pitted farm workers against huge agricultural conglomerates. One of his first cases as a young lawyer had gone all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, where he was lucky to find just enough holdovers from the liberal Warren Court era to produce a landmark ruling that children of Mexican aliens must be allowed to register in schools. He spent another 10 years in Texas legal aid fighting for migrant workers who swam across the Rio Grande to pick cotton in Hereford, Texas. He took on the poultry industry in Arkansas,
where processing plants ruled over local farmers like feudal lords. He battled apple growers in Maryland and lettuce farmers in California. Success was fleeting after that early Supreme Court victory. He drifted from one legal aid clinic to another. When he was in his prime, women were drawn to his aura of romantic self-regard, taken by this passionate Ivy Leaguer who played Mozart on the piano in his spare time and went mountain climbing in Tibet every summer. His personal relationships were short-lived, however, usually ending when a new girlfriend discovered that he had no apartment and slept on the couch at the legal aid office. Then Ed took on Big Sugar, and his life really fell apart.
"Mr. Lincoln, how are you, my friend?" he said, greeting me with a warm embrace.
Ed was one of the few lawyers who knew that my father-in-law called me Abe Lincoln. He knew Luther Vine's cane-cutting story in detail.
"I've been better," I said.
Ed invited me back to his office, which had all the charm of a warehouse. The Florida Farm Aid Legal Clinic was in Belglade, a mostly dirt-poor community that had once been a late-night destination for lonely cutters in search of a good time. 20 years after the demise of the H2 program, Belglade still had one of the highest HIV infection rates in America. The legal aid clinic was a few miles east of the noisy grinding mill for the Sugarcane Growers Cooperative, of which Cortina Sugar was part owner. It was also just a few blocks west of a rat-infested trailer that housed an undocumented dozen of the estimated 45,000 migrant workers who still traveled to Palm Beach County each winter to harvest something other than sugarcane. Ed's office doubled as the clinic's file storage room. Stacks of banker's boxes covered all four walls from floor to ceiling. I assumed there was a window somewhere, but no one would ever find it.
"Have a seat," said Ed.
There was only one guest chair, and I had to clear away three boxes to get into it. Ed went to the wobbly chair behind his desk, resting his elbows on armrests where the leatherette had worn away and duct tape saved the day. I noticed a patch of rust at the corner of the desk, and the stain in the ceiling confirmed that it was from the leaky roof. I'd first met Ed when I was engaged to Samantha. He wanted to see Big Sugar criminally indicted again. He knew my future father-in-law's history with the National Sugar Corporation in the 1940s, and he thought I might warm to the idea of an indictment that would actually stick. The criminal prosecution never got off the ground. It was Ed's last shot at breathing some measure of success into his disastrous class actions. Big Sugar had cheated a generation of Jamaicans, his lawsuit alleged, because paying the workers not by the hour but by the number of rows they cut worked out to less than 60% of the legal minimum wage. After more than a decade of litigation, a jury rejected the claim. Big Sugar switched to machine harvest anyway, tired of being cast by everyone from Vanity Fair to 60 Minutes as an antebellum plantation that exploited humanity. Ed's clients didn't get a dime in back wages, and they were permanently out of a job. Everybody hated Ed, except Ed.
"It was the principle of the thing," he told the media on the courthouse steps, his eyes tearing with bitter disappointment. "So you want to know everything about the sugarcane lawsuit?" he asked, smiling.
I glanced at the wall of cardboard boxes around the room.
"Well, not everything. In fact, it's not so much the case I'm interested in. It's more about your clients." "Good man?"
"All of them," said Ed, his smile fading. "Wish I could have done more for them. There's one in particular I'm hoping to talk to."
"Who?"
"I don't know his name."
"What years was he in the H2 program?"
"I'm not sure."
"Which country was he from?"
"Jamaica, I think, but I don't know for sure."
"Which sugar company did he work for?"
"Cortina's."
"Okay, that's a start. We've narrowed it down to about 40,000 possibilities.
"That many?"
Ed gestured toward the dusty stack of boxes behind him. The class action was filed on behalf of every cane cutter who is part of the H2 program from 1980 going forward. 10,000 cutters came here every year, mostly Jamaicans. Some returned year after year, so we're still talking more than 100,000 in total. Cortina Sugar had about 40% of them. I'm looking for one who might have been a witness to a crime.
They witnessed it every day, said Ed. The whole program was a crime.
It was a well-trodden road in Ed's life, and I didn't want to go down it. That's not what I'm talking about. This would be the kind of crime that could be prosecuted 20 years or more after it was committed.
Not many crimes with a 20-year statute of limitations.
You mean like a homicide?
Possibly. Or at the very least, criminal negligence that caused someone's death. He scratched his head, thinking,
criminal negligence could be a lot of things in agriculture. But the only outright murder I remember involving cane cutters was in the mid-90s.
Tell me about that.
These cutters lived in barracks for months at a time, about one level above Dachau, if you asked me. Tempers flare when you throw hundreds of grown men on top of each other, work them all day long, and give them no privacy at night. Throw a sharp machete into the mix, and someone is bound to snap.
What happened?
One cutter lost his cool and swung his machete at another cutter. Cut his head off. Horrible. The victim had a wife and kids back in Jamaica.
What happened to the killer?
Went to prison. I presume he's still there, but I don't know.
My interest was piqued. But I had to believe that Agent Santos would have already investigated a cane cutter convicted of beheading a co-worker as part of the cutter investigation. My focus wouldn't be on an open and shut crime that's been resolved. I'm looking for a cane cutter who would know everything there is to know about a very serious crime, possibly as serious as homicide. And the crime has never been publicly known, much less solved by law enforcement.
Wow, said Ed. That's not a needle in a haystack, that's a needle in a needle stack.
That's what I was afraid you'd say.
But hold on, said Ed. Let's think this through. Do you have reason to believe that this cane cutter is still alive today?
I replayed Tyler's words in my mind. Yes, I said. I was told pretty recently that I need to talk to an old cutter, and that he knows everything about it.
Okay, if a cane cutter had information about a serious crime, why would he not come forward? Assuming he's not dead.
He's afraid, I said.
That's one good explanation. There's a better one.
Remember, we're dealing with big sugar. I caught his drift. He was bought off.
Bingo.
I sat back in my chair, as did Ed, each of us trying to figure out how our deduction might narrow our list of possibilities from 40,000. It took a minute, and then Ed's face lit up.
Opt-outs, he said.
What? He leaned forward, elbows on his rusty desk.
My class action was like any class action. The court required us to mail notices to all cane cutters who were part of the H2 program and tell them that they were named in the class. It was a total pain in the ass. I had to get 100,000 addresses from the Department of Labor. But here's my point. The notice gave each member of the class a chance to opt out and say that they wanted no part of our lawsuit.
How many of those did you get?
About 75.
I like that number better than 40,000.
Don't get too excited, he said. A lot of the addresses we used were old, the mail didn't get delivered, whatever. But I always wondered about these 75 characters who actually took the time to fill out the form, check off the box to opt out of the lawsuit and mail it back to us.
That does seem strange.
It's beyond strange, said Ed. In my mind, the only explanation is that these guys were in Big Sugar's back pocket. If I'd had the money in my legal aid war chest,
I would have opposed every single one. I was convinced that they opted out of my lawsuit because they knew something about the way Big Sugar cheated the workers on their wages and got paid off to keep quiet. But who knows? Maybe they saw dumping of toxic waste in the Everglades and got bought off. Maybe they witnessed OSHA violations and got bought off. Maybe, well, use your imagination. It could be anything. Anything, I said, nodding. I still didn't know if I was onto something, if Tyler had truly called about criminal activity that could be seriously damaging to her law firm and her client. But I surely didn't buy into the idea that Tyler had made this up to reconnect with me, that she had the psychological makeup of some neurotic who might run her car into a Porsche just to meet the driver. Where do I find this list of opt-outs? I asked. Ed walked around his desk to the stack of boxes behind me. It was leaning to the left, the legal aid version of the Tower of Pisa. "Maybe in one of these," he said, and then he walked toward another tower. "Or here." It was pretty clear that he had no idea. "You don't have it on computer?" Ed laughed. "That's a good one, Abe." "Yeah," I said, only half smiling. Hilarious. Chapter 18. I bought groceries on the way home from Belglade and dropped them at JT's apartment. The world nearly ended when he saw that I had purchased his root beer in 12-ounce cans instead of 12-ounce bottles, but I had the perfect diversion. We were off to see Luther. It was 3 p.m, the geriatric version of happy hour, when we reached the Sunny Gardens nursing home in Miami Shores, which meant a bunch of old folks in wheelchairs parked in a semicircle in the courtyard and watching the Friday afternoon entertainer. My father-in-law had a prime spot, dead center, near the fountain. The magician had his undivided attention. "Keep your eye on the Queen of Diamonds," the magician told his geriatric audience. "She's in your left pocket," shouted Luther. He'd seen the act before, about 100 times, but I was happy to see him engaged and with it. That wasn't always the case. Nighttime was generally tougher than daylight. Sunset was worst of all. Sundowner syndrome, they called it. Thankfully, we'd caught him before dinner.
"Abe," he said.
"Your son's here too," said JT.
"Devin?"
"No, Devin's dead, Pop. It's JT.
An old woman shushed us. The even older man next to her scowled and shouted,
"Shut up yourself, lady. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas."
I had no idea what the poor old guy was talking about. I wheeled Luther to the other end of the courtyard where we could talk.
"You look good, old man," I said.
"Don't you know it?"
said Luther. Truthfully, I barely recognized him anymore. He'd shed 20 pounds in the last year, and it showed in his face. The barber had given him a buzz cut to keep him from yanking his hair out in the occasional fits of confusion, but it made him look even more skeletal. "How's your girlfriend?" I asked.
"Oh, she's old news. Got my eye on a sweet thing from Kansas City. She just moved in Thursday."
"Good luck with that."
"How you doing?" asked Luther. "You dating yet?" "Samantha would want you to find someone, you know."
I told him many times that I'd remarried. Either he kept forgetting or it just never registered. "Life's good," I said, rolling with it.
"Good. That's good. Life is good."
"Abe's been working in the sugarcane fields," said JT.
I shot him a look, making it clear that I would have rather not brought that up. Luther's eyes clouded with concern.
"Oh, no, Abe, you don't want to do that.
They're gonna charge you for the blanket. They're gonna charge you for the knife. They're gonna charge you for the water you drink and the pot you piss in. You ain't never gonna make no money cutting, Luther. It's not that. Don't worry, I'm not cutting sugarcane.
He's trying to catch a serial killer,
said JT. Luther's eyes widened.
A killer?
Somebody murdered his girlfriend.
JT, that's enough.
Girlfriend, said Luther. You got a girlfriend?
Not anymore,
said JT.
Somebody whacked her with a machete.
Oh, my,
said Luther. JT, stop, I said.
They think Abe did it.
I grabbed JT by the wrist and asked Luther to excuse us for a moment. Luther's hearing was poor, especially in his right ear, so I didn't have to pull JT very far to light into him.
JT, what the hell are you doing?
You think I couldn't hear you talking to the FBI agent and the detective last night?
I was wide awake in my bedroom. It's like a tin can in that apartment. I can hear everything.
Agent Santos never said Tyla was my girlfriend, and she sure as hell never said that I'm suspected of killing her.
Not in so many words. I could hear it in her voice.
You don't know what you're talking about, JT. Just stop it. You weren't even in the room, and you heard no such thing in Agent Santos' voice.
Sure I did, Abe. I'm good at hearing voices, remember?
You told the judge I'm bipolar. Now I understood. He was still ticked off at me about the court hearing.
JT, just because you're bipolar doesn't mean you're delusional and hear voices. That's a stereotype.
Just because you think I'm bipolar doesn't mean I am bipolar.
It's your doctor's diagnosis.
The doctor's wrong. Which is one more reason why you shouldn't have told the judge I'm bipolar.
JT, for the last time, I never told the judge you're bipolar.
How do you like being hit with bullshit accusations? Not cool, is it?
I have never accused you of anything, JT.
You should have told the judge the truth. Should have told him that I have post-traumatic stress disorder.
JT, you don't have PTSD.
All those years cutting cane gave me PTSD.
This is not funny, JT. And it's not cool to be making jokes about being a cane cutter when my office is investigating these serial killings.
How do you know I'm joking?
Maybe I'm being delusional.
I never said you were delusional.
There you go, then. I do have cane cutter PTSD.
You didn't cut cane. Your father cut cane. He paused, and I hoped he was tiring of this game, which is usually what he did, so long as I didn't lose my cool. But then his eyes narrowed and he turned his glare in Luther's direction.
That crazy son of a bitch is not my father.
Don't ever say that. Your father loves you.
If he's my father, then why didn't my bone marrow match Samantha's?
It was the 500th time we'd had this conversation. High doses of chemotherapy and radiation were supposed to kill Samantha's cancer cells, but they'd also destroyed bone marrow, where blood cells are made. JT had been our last hope. It's like the doctors told us, siblings are usually the best shot, but it's not a guaranteed match.
If I had given bone marrow, Samantha wouldn't have died.
You weren't a match, JT. That's not your fault.
Maybe another test would have showed I was a match.
We did all the tests, I said. And then some.
Maybe they made a mistake. Another test might have caught the mistake. Did you ever think of that?
They didn't make a mistake.
Don't tell me doctors never make mistakes,
he said sharply. Keep your voice down, please. I didn't say doctors never make mistakes.
Then how do you know my doctor didn't make a mistake when he said I'm bipolar?
I was on the verge of losing it. JT, This whole conversation is getting stupid.
Take that back, Abe. Just because I was a cane cutter don't mean I'm stupid.
JT, you never cut cane.
You saying I'm stupid?
No, I'm saying... I stopped for air. I could hardly believe that I was playing along as if this were rational conversation, but patiently walking JT through these episodes of verbal combativeness was the only way to make sure it didn't end badly, with JT pacing all night or skipping across the room till dawn. JT, the last time any American cut sugarcane in Florida was 1941. You're African-American, not Jamaican, and you never cut cane. Luther leaned forward in his wheelchair and shouted,
"Stop talking shit, motherfucker!"
The old man's hearing was apparently better than he let on, or maybe we were louder than I'd thought. JT and I exchanged one final glance, my last effort to bring him under control. "Take a deep breath, JT.
I'm still pissed at you, Abe."
"I know. Just breathe for me, okay?" My cell rang. I told JT to hold tight, stepped a little farther away from him and Luther, and took the call. It was Ed, still at the Farm Aid office.
"Don't you ever go home?" I asked.
"This is my home."
I'd forgotten. "What's up?"
"I was going through these boxes."
"Ed, please, you don't have to do that." We'd left it that I would come up over the weekend and do it myself.
"It's no trouble," he said. "If there's a chance that we could uncover a crime committed by Big Sugar, I'm all over it. Anyway, I have the name of a cutter for you."
"Okay, but if you tell me his name is JT and you hear a loud pop on the line, it's just me blowing my brains out." "What?" "Nothing, go ahead."
"Vernon Gallagher, Kingston, Jamaica. He cut cane for Cortina Sugar from 1981 to 1986.
"What makes him stand out?"
"I checked the pay records. Cortina's kept daily task tickets for each cutter because they paid these guys by the row. Some guys took 2 days to cut a single row. Gallagher could cut 2 rows in a single day. For 6 years, he cut more tonnage than almost anybody else on the field. The guy was a stud, the freaking Michael Phelps of cane cutting. He stood to gain more than just about anybody from this class action."
"But he opted out of the class," I said, intrigued.
"He opted out. Remember,
if a cutter did nothing and just ignored the class notice, he was in the lawsuit and shared in whatever money we might collect. But Gallagher took the time to read over this 8-page legal document in small print, sign the opt-out form, put a stamp on the envelope, and drop it off at the post office. He wanted no part of suing Cortina Sugar."
"Interesting," I said. "Either he was in the company's back pocket," said Ed, "or he was scared to death of them."
"That's a pretty big leap at this point."
"For you, maybe, but not for me."
"Why not for you?" I asked, and somehow I knew that he was smiling on the other end of the line.
"You don't know the history," he said,
"but I do. There was some big shit going on at Cortina's in 1986. Really big."
Chapter 19. Pumpkin hour for JT was 6 p.m., so I drove him straight back from the nursing home. The court's order on house arrest gave us a 3-hour window to visit Luther each week, which meant that I was off the hook until next Friday. I had been leaving messages all day for Angelina and tried her one more time from my car in the parking lot outside JT's apartment. This time she picked up.
"Hey," I said, a little startled not to get her voicemail.
"How are you?"
"Fine." "Fine." Delivered the right way at exactly the right moment, it was the most vulgar of all 4-letter words.
"I was thinking maybe we could meet for happy hour and get some sushi."
"I'm having dinner with my mother."
"Not fine."
"Your mother's in town?" I'm picking her up at the airport in 30 minutes. Don't worry, she's not staying with us. She insisted on a hotel. I could join you at the restaurant if it's dinner with my mother, Abe, just us.
Okay, well, say hello to her for me. Maybe you and I can get a drink later.
Mom will probably want to see a movie after. That sounded bogus. After a flight from New York and dinner? Sounds like fun. What are you going to see? Truthfully, Abe, I couldn't care less. I'll see you later at home, okay?
Okay,
I said, not wanting it to end on that note, but there was only silence coming back from her. Angelina.
What?
I'm sorry.
No response.
Just a moment of hesitation, and then she hung up. I laid my phone on the dashboard, started the car engine, and blasted the air conditioner to help me breathe again. After a full day of straight to voicemail, I supposed it was a good sign that Angelina had finally answered my call and that she was planning on coming home later tonight. But I was still betting on Ice Age, not for the movie they were supposedly going to see, but for our indefinite future. Which left me with a huge dilemma. Friday night was the memorial service for Tyler Tompkins. My intention had been to steer clear of all the services for Tyler. Over the years, I'd paid my respects to dozens of homicide victims, and I'd never missed a service where I was the prosecutor assigned to the investigation. But I was officially off Tyler's case. With all the media coverage of the Cutter serial killer investigation, Carmen had planned to attend Tyler's service herself. The Miami-Dade state attorney is, after all, an elected official, so it had come as something of a surprise when Carmen pulled me into her office earlier in the day and asked me to accompany her to the service. She'd made a fairly compelling case.
Rumors are flying, Abe. No matter how firmly I say that I pulled you because of a personal relationship with the victim that was over and done with 10 years ago, people talk. If you come with me to the service tonight, it reinforces our public position that nothing recent and nothing untoward was going on between you and Tyler.
I appreciate the offer, I told her, but I'm not going. It was a position that I had staked out with personal and professional conviction, but I'd been rethinking it all day. Not for the reason Carmen had given. One much more compelling was weighing on my mind. I knew Carmen well enough to finally come to the realization that this other reason, the one she'd only implied, was the real reason behind her invitation. I glanced in the rearview mirror as if to check my own resolve. Then I dialed Carmen on my cell and told her that I would meet her at the funeral home.
That's a good decision, she said. We don't have to stay long.
That's fine, I said. This won't take long. We hung up. And I was certain that Carmen understood what I had meant by this. I wanted to meet Brian Belter man to man, face to face. I didn't want to miss the opportunity to see him at a time and at a place where I could look him right in the eye and see all the way to his soul. And I needed to do this. For me.
Chapter 20.
A memorial service was scheduled for 7 at Seaver's funeral home, just off Miami Avenue. It was closer to 6:30, half an hour past sunset, when I found a parking space and killed the engine. There was no rush, but if I intended to go through with this, I needed to do more than sit frozen behind the wheel, unable to open the car door. The internal conflict was on many levels. Angelina and Tyler were obviously at the center of it, but there was more. Seaver's was where we'd held the memorial service for Samantha.
Just do this, I told myself.
Tyler had been part of a large professional family, a mega law firm that numbered more than 300 attorneys in the Miami office alone, not to mention administrators, staff, and the spouses of all of the above. Friday evening service was for the broader group,
with the more intimate service for her family and closest friends scheduled for Saturday morning at the Mission Hill Baptist Church of Coconut Grove. A necktie was in order, and fortunately, mine was still in the back seat, along with my jacket from the morning court appearance. A shave wouldn't have hurt, but the best I could do was run a comb through my hair. I drew a breath, clutched my keys, and stepped out of the car into the early evening darkness. You have to do this. The parking lot was filling up quickly. Visitors came from various directions, some having parked a block or more down the street, others in the overflow lot, across from the funeral home. One woman was sobbing and dabbing away tears. Others appeared numb, or at the very least, at a loss for words. I looked away, only to catch sight of the black hearse parked beneath the porte cochere alongside the building. The thought of Tyler heading to a cemetery was almost incomprehensible, but she wouldn't be laid to rest anytime soon. The family didn't want to put off the service any longer, but the burial plan was on hold until law enforcement advised that there was absolutely no hope of ever recovering the rest of the body. The search in the Everglades was ongoing, and it seemed that all but Tyler's immediate family had come to accept that her head would never be found. "Wait up, Abe." It was Carmen. I stopped long enough for her to catch me, and together we walked to the entrance.
"You okay?"
she asked. Carmen knew the history with Samantha at Seavers.
"Better than I thought I would be."
There was a small gathering of guests at the sign-in register in the lobby. I let Carmen sign first, and it somehow made me feel better about showing up at Tyler's memorial to see my name directly below hers. As if that made it more legitimate, or at least okay. Several other clusters of quiet conversation dotted the room. Bouquets of white roses and chrysanthemums adorned antique tables. It was all very subdued and traditional, except for the poster-sized photographs of Tyler that greeted us in the parlor. Her childhood was to the right. On the immediate left was Tyler, the track star. Not an ounce of fat on her body as she flew across the finish line in the 800-meter run. Next was Tyler in her crimson robe, graduation day from Harvard Law. And on it went, all along the wall, one shot from each stage of her life.
"You sure you're okay with this?"
Carmen asked quietly.
"I'm sure."
Barely had the response crossed my lips before I took a turn for the worse. It was surely the photographs, but whatever the reason, the words Carmen had spoken to me in her office, that Tyler was a symptom of a grieving man adrift, were rushing through my mind. "Abe, I'm not blind. Tyler is a beautiful woman, and she looks one heck of a lot like Samantha." It all left a knot in my stomach.
"Thank you for coming,"
a young man said. I turned and he was addressing Carmen. He introduced himself as Tyler's brother.
"It means a lot to our family for the state attorney to make the time to be here," he said.
Carmen expressed her sympathies and introduced me. I took his hand, making no mention of how long I'd known Tyler.
"This is so painful," he said. "We didn't want to have to do two services, but the outpouring from Tyler's law firm was overwhelming. BB&L was so good to her."
"It's obvious she was very highly regarded at her firm," I said.
"Very,"
he said, his gaze drifting toward Tyler's law school graduation photo.
"Last Thanksgiving, Tyler and I had a nice talk. She told me how she was promoted from doing the work for Cortina Sugar, which everybody at BB&L does, to doing the legal work for the Cortina's family, which is like an invitation to the inner sanctum. She was so proud. I work in D.C., and the only person I've seen happier about a promotion was a friend of mine who got a White House press pass."
Her brother smiled wistfully at the memory, and I smiled with him. But it was the first I'd heard of Tyler being part of the Cortina's family inner sanctum. It put yet another shade of light on her voicemail message.
"Y'all go ahead and find seats," he said. "We're going to start soon."
He stepped away. I followed Carmen down the side aisle. There were more photographs, each one separated from the next by an impressive stand of flowers.
We passed a magnificent arrangement of roses on our way to an opened row of seating. It was by far the largest single assortment in the room, and I checked the card. With deepest sympathy, the Cortinas family. It certainly backed up what Tyler's brother had just told me. We found open seats on the aisle, and I checked the printed program on the seat. Another image of Tyler was on the front, but I went right to the list of speakers. Brian Belter was the first eulogist. I was about to point out his name to Carmen, but Maggie Green had strategically grabbed the seat beside Carmen and snagged her attention. I didn't know Green well, but Agent Santos had told me that the former federal prosecutor was part of the meeting she and Reed had attended at BB&L. Green was working Carmen hard. "This isn't the appropriate time," said Green, "but I need to follow up with you on the search of Tyler's computer files and emails at the firm. I received a subpoena today from the feds, and I'd like to coordinate with both your office and the U.S. attorney."
"Maggie, you are so right," said Carmen. "This isn't the appropriate time, but I'm available."
A young lawyer approached, beyond obsequious, clearly a first or second year associate with little more standing in the firm than a messenger.
"Sorry to interrupt, Ms. Green."
Green looked annoyed.
"What is it?" "It looks like you're going to have to speak."
"What?"
"Mr. Belter can't make it this evening."
Carmen glanced in my direction. His sudden no-show was intriguing, but Carmen played it cool.
"Oh no, has Brian taken ill?"
"Called out of town," the young lawyer said, "unexpectedly."
"I see. These things happen," said Carmen.
Green shook the state attorney's hand and thanked her.
"I'll be in touch."
"I'll wait for your call," said Carmen. Green and the BB&L associate left, and Carmen and I returned to our seats.
"Out of town, my ass,"
Carmen whispered through her teeth.
"Coward."
"The worst kind," I said. "But I'm still glad we came," Carmen said. I was thinking of those words from Tyler's brother, curious to know what Tyler might have learned in that inner sanctum, and wondering what the Michael Phelps of cane cutting might tell me when I followed up on Ed Brumble's lead.
"Me too," I said.
Chapter 21. Agent Santos attended Tyler's memorial service, but no one would ever know it. That was the way she wanted it. The disguise was not elaborate, and it was certainly nothing like what an agent might do for an undercover operation. But the blonde wig, funeral-appropriate hat, and general low profile were enough to keep anyone from recognizing her. Even Abe Beckham had walked right past her. Wandering the room with no one aware that she was an FBI agent was an excellent way to pick up a stray comment that might not otherwise be shared with law enforcement. Some unvarnished truth about Tyler or someone she knew that might help catch a serial killer. It could be a friend expressing her suspicions of one of Tyler's old boyfriends, or maybe a relative wondering out loud about a cousin who was just a little too fond of Tyler. By Victoria's estimate, Tyler's service had drawn close to 700 guests. It was to be expected, given the tragic death of such a young and successful woman, a partner at a prominent law firm killed so senselessly. At one point or another, Victoria had her eye on each of them. Most were from BB&L or other prominent law firms, many of them sad or even grief-stricken. A few had come purely out of professional obligation, signing the registry, expressing brief condolences to the family, and leaving before the eulogies. Still others had nothing to do with Tyler's life at BB&L. Older guests consoled Tyler's parents, occasionally taking a seat on the couch to rest their swollen feet. Some were there for Tyler's two older brothers. Some barely knew anyone in the room, speaking to no one, perhaps old friends from high school or the neighborhood where Tyler had grown up, having lost touch with Tyler years earlier, but feeling the loss nonetheless. Victoria's interest was in none of them, but not because she didn't care. She was looking for the lone wolf in the crowd.
She knew from years of experience, both at Quantico and in the field, that when it came to serial killers, the stereotypes were often true. It heightened the thrill to return to the